Accession number 2, 8935, reel 6.
Miss Fire, reel 6. So what was the role of the squadron during the attacks on the Tirpitz?
Fleet protection. An original role. In other words, we were nice and safe, whilst the Barracudas and the Hellcats and the Wildcats pushed off and did their stuff. And that is all we did. Flew anti-submarine patrols around the fleet.
This period, were there any incidents that occurred during this service that you did in the Atlantic and the Arctic that we should mention? Any other incidents that spring to mind that happened within the squadron? Or to yourself during these patrols?
Not really. I know that we were a very happy squadron. We didn't have people coming and going. We were much the same crowd at the end of our two-year stint as began. We had no idea how successful we'd been. This is one of the strange things, you know. There were, of course, many squadrons, but we didn't meet very often. And when we did, it would be at places like Macrahanish, staging posts, if you like, for a few days. So we didn't know what we were achieving. In fact, in our case, we certainly didn't know for months and months afterwards that we had been any use whatsoever. One of our pilots after the war, I remember at an early reunion, said, yes, you know, we felt, I can't remember exactly how he put it, he said, the Admiralty must have been scraping the bottom of the barrel to get people like us. My feeling since then has been, well, some scrapings.
One question with, obviously, the squadron staying together, did that include those who would deal with your aircraft?
Yes. The ground crew stayed with us. We were very fortunate. We only served in three carriers, to my knowledge, operationally. The squadron split between the Furious and the Indefatigable for the Tirpitz runs, but otherwise we were just this one aircraft carrier that nobody has ever heard of, Fenson.
And with aircraft, one of the things is, how were they maintained? Where would the maintenance take place? You had a hangar within the aircraft?
The maintenance was in the hangar. Now, I'm glad you mentioned that, because one forgets these chaps who are working on the aircraft. You consider that you've got a metal deck, on which aircraft are being serviced, and therefore oil is falling. It's never easy to keep a metal deck completely grease-free. So it's slidey, and the ship is rolling and pitching and thundering and banging. And yet these men had to get on ladders, climb up, handle equipment, replace engines, replace wings, replace undercarriages. A considerable task with your ship moving around and jumping around. But they did it.
You also mentioned that obviously crashing was an occupational hazard.
Crashing? Oh, absolutely.
Were there any incidents when you crashed on deck?
Oh, yes, I remember one. Bay of Biscay, December 1944. You know, when there is a storm, a bad storm in the offing, the wind drops to absolutely nothing. You still have your swell, but the swell itself becomes longer, uneven, and the surface of the water is oily. All the marks of trouble ahead. Now we had a patrol up. I was of three aircraft. I was one of the aircraft. But the ship couldn't be headed by the captain in a given a heading which would enable him to have the wind down the flight deck, as was normally required, without excessive roll and pitch. He was trying to marry up a total lack of wind with an unsteady sea state, an uncertain sea state, I'd describe it, speed which would reduce the risk of accidents. In other words, we were almost stationary, the ship was almost stationary, to avoid over excessive movement. Do I make sense to you? Yes. Good. Right. So we have three aircraft up. The chap in front of me ends up crashing ahead of the crash barrier. That's accident one. The ship's still caught in trying to box the compass. Do you know what is meant by boxing the compass? All right, trying to find that heading. No wind over the deck. I'm the next chap to come in. I bounce heavily. I know that I haven't got any deck left, so I deliberately go for the barrier, the crash barrier, and I crash into the barrier. Now, there's a third aircraft up, and the convoy, incidentally, is not very close. We've had to turn out of it. We have this third aircraft to bring on. They get my aircraft over the dump it over the ship's side smartly. Whilst they're doing that, I go forward of the bridge and stand in the catwalk to watch the third chap come in, and I watch him. And he comes in, he bounces heavily, tries to go round again, disobeying instructions, and he had to make a report after this. Bounced heavily, tried to go round again, opened up, lost sight of the flight deck beneath him, drifted to starboard, crashed into the superstructure above the island, and went vertical down into the sea alongside the bridge. And the crew were rescued. Open cockpit, certain to save lives in a swordfish. The loss of life in the swordfish when in accident or action was less in because of that open cockpit. You can get out of it. Right, so here's the third aircraft gone. So you asked me about accidents. I've told you, they're quite unusual. One, two, three, just like that, all gone. Not long afterwards, a violent storm came up. Absolutely violent. We had our aircraft in the hangar lashed down, triple lashed, bottle screw lashings. That also meant that we had to have every movable piece of equipment, including any equipment on wheels where you had hard rubber tires, small diameter. That contraption is the most likely to go because it's on rubber, it's on a greasy deck. You can lash it until the cars come home. The slightest movement after 3 or 4 hours is going to just stretch to the point where suddenly something goes. And if that fellow goes, and it has been known to happen in an escort carrier, lost every aircraft in the hangar, that goes, it goes right through the lot. I've been a hang control officer as well. I've been a flight deck officer, and I've been a deck landing, a batsman. But from a hangar point of view, in conditions like that, you put one man in the hangar only, and he is there to raise the alarm, because otherwise it's too dangerous. Well, on this particular occasion, we split the ship's hull, forward, port side. I may say that ship became a Greek cruise liner under five different names after the war. The first name, I think, was Galaxy Queen. All right, so we split the hangar. Every piece of equipment in the wardroom broke adrift, welded to the deck. Our tables were welded to the deck. Made no difference. They bust. And trying to catch that load of stuff, careering around the wardroom with rope to coral it, we went to 44 degrees roll on this particular occasion. I'm told that that class of carrier can go to 58 degrees. And to my way of thinking, I would not wish to be on board when the test is carried out to prove that.
How did you come to leave the squadron after 2 years?
I to leave the squadron. Well, the squadron was disbanded. We went to Coast Command and flew patrols from the Outer Hebrides, and then down to Thorny Island after the invasion. things had got quiet down there by then. We were fortunate, but we flew patrols as far as the Channel Islands and so forth.
Were they the same type of patrols that you would have flown from the carrier?
Exactly the same object, but we were looking for a different type of boat. That these were the Volta boats, which are supposed to give off a sign of their presence by clouds of something or other coming out of the schnorkel or whatever it's called. Anyway, that was that, and then we disbanded, and I went off, because I had always been the squadron batsman as well. I was sent off on a course to become a proper batsman, to go and do this work on board a carrier. When I described myself as a squadron batsman, that merely means that ashore I was required to bat my fellow pilots for training, but I wasn't allowed to do so on board a ship. Now I was sent off to do the thing properly, and I then went on to commission the Glory, which was a light fleet carrier going out to the Pacific.
What was your role then as the batsman? How did that differ from obviously the role that you've mentioned a little bit about what the batsman does, but how did you organise your day?
There were two of us. We had two on, I think, all the light fleets. In fact, certainly the fleets had. I think the escort carriers only had one. Our escort carrier only had one batsman. But then when the larger ships where you're operating both day and night, you've got to have this. So that was my function, just to bat these Corsairs and Barracuda and Firefly and things like that going out to the Pacific.
With those types of aircraft, obviously you had a fairly good all-round visibility in the Swordfish that you'd flown. What about those types of aircraft?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. The most notable aircraft where it was necessary to have good vision was the Corsair. That was a gull-wing aircraft, huge engine. The vision from the cockpit forward was nil, some 14 foot plus up to the propeller boss, I think. So he had to come on the turn. The trouble with the Corsair was that it didn't like to stall, and when it did, it did so very quickly. It was a devil. But that one aircraft, above any other, had to be brought in really on a good turn. No question of bringing it in straight in and expecting the pilot to see you.
How easy was it to do that with the Corsairs?
Let me explain. The batsman has a certain protection, and that is a net set outboard of the batsman's platform. And the net is quite a deep one. And if you jump into it, you will then find that there is a funk hole that you can push yourself through smartly in beneath the flight deck. So if an aircraft crashes on your batsman's platform and catches fire, you do stand a chance. In fact, I think that the batsman's chances were not that good. I had to jump once or twice, yes. And it was always because of the Corsair. The Corsair would give a warning sign. A sort of wisp would appear off the port wingtip, showing that the stall was about to take place. And that was a signal to depart, which I would do. Yes. You see, torque stall. It is the torque stall we're talking about. Now, you think of the Sea Fury. The Sea Fury would go torque stall to starboard. He would get a wave off, perhaps a bit late by the batsman. I've been a flight deck officer on another flight, light fleet, and watched this for a long time. He'd get a late wave off, shall we say, and he opens the throttle too fast, and the next thing you know, he's turned on his back starboard ways and crashed alongside down the port side. Whereas the Corsair, it's a messier business. The American aircraft are interesting. I made this comment at the London Air Show the other day to an American. I said, yes, your aircraft, compared with ours, I'm afraid, were flamers. And he asked, well, what do you mean, Miller? So I tried to explain whether I did so successfully or not, I don't know. But what I mean is this. For reasons which I don't know, but they tended to catch fire more easily when crashing than British aircraft. That is fact. Now, if you watch the Pacific War, you'll see the number of them crashing, catching fire. You see the number of them on fire. Many great shots of aircraft coming in, undercarts gone, whatever. Then they catch fire. Our aircraft, very rarely.
Did you wear any sort of protective clothing as a deck landing officer?
No.
Would you wear something noticeable at all?
Yes. Only for the purpose of... if you're a flight deck officer, you're doing it to show that you're the flight deck officer. You must be clearly seen. Anybody working on a flight deck must have very clear, clearly understood garments.
So what did you wear?
I had a yellow jacket. Now, you had a yellow jacket, and in those days we were rather primitive, not much else. My chiefs also had yellow jackets, so you couldn't really tell. But that's the way things were then. But nowadays, you notice a well-organized flight deck. There are various colors. And remember, the flight deck is a very, very dangerous place. Very dangerous. You need to be able to see everywhere and to hear everything. And you can't do it. You notice today that they wear earmuffs. The noise is dreadful. Keeping your footing is difficult when you're heading into wind. You imagine a fleet carrier going at 30 knots into a wind which is already 15 knots. You've got 45 knots over the deck. You are having difficulty keeping your footing. You've got proper footwear, but the only thing that's going to stop you is grabbing an arrest wire or a ring bolt. The flight deck and the hangar is a mass of ring bolts to which you can always attach a lashing. Just like that. You've got lashings everywhere. So, you have noise, you have wind. Around you, you have got engines running. In my day, the engines propelled nasty things which hit you. Today, you have engines which suck you in and blow you away and so forth. Watching the flight deck crew at launch time is an education. The way they get around, they move around, they're on their hands and, you know, hands down, keep steadying themselves with their hands. It's an art form, because there are chocks involved. And now you've got to move those chocks. Oh, it's quite an interview.
And with your bats... Was there some way of them being sewn in? I'm thinking if you were batting somebody in at dusk, or if there was...
At dusk I would use night bats. Well, no, night bats, they weren't bats, they were wands. One was wired up through one's sleeves to a wand with a cupped light bulb, each cup. And on your chest you had a bulb. So you lined the three up and... just the same signals, but I must tell you in all honesty that you really didn't know what you were seeing as a batsman. You can't really tell the speed of an aircraft when you can only just see one light approaching. To give him a speed signal is a risky job. You can give him a height signal, you can judge that. But it is, you're really, it's a by guess and by God for a night batsman, I can assure you.
You mentioned obviously how dangerous that the flight deck can be.
Yes.
Were there lots of occasions where accidents occurred?
Accidents could occur far too easily. I'll give you an example, or several examples. Remember that you don't have neat handholds. You don't have railings anywhere. So if you get blown aft and down over the rundown, there's nothing to stop you, you're in the oggin. There are lifts going up and down. Now the only way of knowing what the lift is doing is by listening, and as the lift is coming up or down, there's a bell that rings. When it is down, there's nothing to tell you that it is down. You've got a great big hole in your flight deck here, which you may fall down, or if you're riding a piece of flight deck equipment, you may go down with that equipment. That has happened. There is, of course, the business of walking into a propeller. And I have seen the consequences. And you could, a piece no bigger than your little thumbnail is left. That is the sort of thing you have to be aware of. It is so dangerous.
Is it dangerous when an aircraft would, say, hit the barrier and then the propeller would splinter? Would
yes. There is debris from a crash. You very good point, from a propeller, except that in my time we didn't have wooden propellers on the... There were wooden propellers on the Barracuda, I believe, early Mark. But, yes, that is the sort of thing that can happen. It's stuff flying around. Another thing, you have a crash which the Swordfish, shall we say, has still got its rockets on, and you'll find those things skittering up the flight deck. So the blokes up forward have got to watch out what's happening aft. All the time, you've got to watch what's happening. What's happening on the deck? Is there something in the air? Is it coming to the... you know? There are all sorts of things.
Really, one last question now. How do you feel about having served with the Fleet Air Arm during the Second World War?
How do I feel about it? I was lucky. Yes, I'm glad I did it. Yes. Very lucky and very privileged, actually. And my greatest privilege, and I'll tell you now, my greatest privilege was actually to have had the Swordfish to fly in. That was it.